Thank you very much for allowing me to speak. I think the last speaker's comments were very relevant to moving on to the theme of young women as citizens. This is taking a different language, if you like, of calling young women citizens. It's not just about gender or about girls. So we're moving into the discourse of citizenship. I'm going to be talking and drawing on some thoughts, some findings, but also some thoughts that came out of this project we've been running in, from Cambridge, with four country partners, Ghana, Kenya, India and Pakistan. This was a major project over 5 years working. My particular project with my colleagues was focusing on youth between the ages of 15 to 25 in rural sites of rural and urban poverty. The approach was using a voice perspective. The most important thing for us is actually hearing the voice of young people. And that's how we move forward in our view. And that's certainly how we've moved forward in Britain in terms of hearing young women's voices. I've put out some quotes here because these are challenging quotes. I'm trying to get some food for thought for the discussion groups later. One of the issues is that when we start talking about young women as citizens, are we not actually having to rethink notions of nationality and citizenship? It's not just a question of slotting into an existing framework. We have, as we've already been hearing, that poverty is actually a central element of female subordination. It's not something separate. We have to engage with poverty issues. We have to engage with citizenship as an emotional issue. It's about not just dreams, it's about being, becoming, and longing to become. It's about the emotional attachments of citizenship. That's how we talk about it today, not just legal political status. And finally, it's about the relations between men and women. And I do seriously want to bring men into the picture in our discussions. That you cannot divorce girls from gender relations, and you can't divorce gender relations from discussing the relations, the contract between men and women. So we're talking about a relational world, and until we engage with that relational world, girls will not change in our view of the position in society. Young women are on the move. It's not they're static. They're not just a category, a statistical category. They are experiencing all the great social forces of this era, of this century. Globalization, which is about urbanization. A huge force towards individualization, which in many of the countries represented here and in our project, it's an incredibly enormous force, individualization. And the more we bring in schooling, the more we bring in individualization. It's my schooling, it's my career, it's my job, it's my future. We start talking I. And that's in itself a huge social disruption. And it produces disruptions between increasing inequalities between rich and poor. Also, it challenges traditional cultures, ethnic, patriarchal, gerontocratic, gender cultures, not just gender, but the whole spectrum of cultures are challenged by girls' education. It's a force for change. When we went into the project, we started with this lovely picture. We all put together four countries this picture. Citizenship is not just about voting. It's not just about being represented in Parliament, but that's a good issue. But it's also about livelihood and enterprise, getting jobs and building an employment life, if you like. It's about self-protection and well-being. It's about agency and empowerment. Citizenship is the whole package, not just the access to one aspect of political power. Now, the study that we did was this intergenerational study, which I can't go into in great detail here, but we did interview mothers and fathers and young men and women in 20 households in each of our sites, and we looked at young people with different schooling histories. There is obviously a considerable diversity, as Elaine pointed out, the diversity between those who've had no schooling, some schooling, or more schooling, and that ours were just in the poverty group. What we find in all our countries, of course, post-independence, 50 years, around about 50 years post-independence, four Commonwealth countries, that there's been this tremendous emphasis on citizenship education, uniting people behind the flag, the anthem, the history of the struggle, and that's where you find the unity amongst youth, and young women have got that message as well. They feel Kenyan, they feel Ghanaian. There's a powerful messages coming out that no matter how poor you are included in the national project. But of course, as schooling comes in and the statistics that Chris showed, you're getting increasing divisions between those who are educated and those who are uneducated or left behind. those who have will not get to school, who will not achieve literacy, who are in a sense outside the frame of citizenship because they've not entered into the frame of that civic entitlement to a school, to have schooling. So of course that means we should be looking at the girls who've got left behind, as well as the girls who start to become joining the educated. It's a new social stratification on top of existing other types of stratifications. We certainly can see that those who've been to secondary school have a much more reflective and critical awareness of what it means to be a citizen, how to relate to other people, other from other cultures, other ways of being. They're much more reflexive than you would find from the primary school educator, basic school education. Now, I'm going to be controversial and say, what are the themes that we've had to reflect on from our project? And one of the things that I think is interesting from the point of view of the female Commonwealth citizen is these are countries deeply affected by British history, the British models of citizenship, which, of course, we exported. And while we were framing 19th century values around gender, we were also exporting them. And many of the school systems we see in the countries we work in have the legacy of the British model of liberal democracy. And I'm going to talk just a little bit about that because it's a problematic model for anyone who's going to argue about women achieving greater citizenship because fundamentally it separates the public and the private spheres. And the second one, which is incredibly interesting at the moment, is we see a revitalization of human rights globally. And when we go in to talk to youth, we hear the language of human rights. But increasingly, in the conferences I'm going to, I hear that it's being seen as not just universal, but it's a secular agenda, which is challenging the religious traditions of the countries that it's where it's being promoted. And it certainly has been promoted very strongly, and I'm sure through many of our organisations here, but it's an issue around reflecting on that. And the third element is about, not just I'm going to raise the issue about not just formal gender equality we've heard about, but what do we mean by substantive gender equality? And that's where we're going to have to look at masculinity. We're going to have to look at other aspects of equality that are not just in the policymakers' arena or the governance arena, but down in the intimate lives of people, the private spheres where change is happening. So these are very, very interesting 21st century debates. The first one is, what do we do when we are promoting citizenship models or we've left legacies in school systems where we have got divisions between boys, the male private sphere and the female private sphere and the male public sphere. It was ingrained in our model, the British model of the school system. Certainly in Britain, we've taken 50 years to challenge it to encourage girls into science. Because you've got a gender-differentiated curriculum, girls should be educated to be mothers for the domestic sphere, you'd be good at cooking, you'd be good at art, you'd be good maybe at social science, but science is outside your frame. You may not have a very good job at the end because you're going to be a wife and mother. That was the model that we spent 50 years of the Queen's Movement trying to challenge in the British context. Those gender-differentiated notions which teachers held to, young kids held to. When we went into the project asking teachers, what is the model of a good citizen? And I did a project with four countries in Europe, the Mediterranean countries. The British teachers said very clearly that the public sphere was male, that the model of the good citizen was, in fact, the worker or the voter in other countries. Now it's the soldier, we have the hero. It's not the mother, it's not in the Protestant cultures, it's not the mother or the grandmother. When we interviewed teachers in Spain, Greece and Portugal, they said it's the grandmother who's the good citizen. It's the mother who's the real citizen because she cares. But that's not our Anglo-Saxon tradition. So I would want to say where we need the research into the school systems where girls are not coming through, and saying what model is being used about what sphere they're being educated for. Does it come through the school textbooks? Does it come through the teachers' attitudes? Let's look at that distinction and whether it's still in place, embedded historically. Where does this leave us? Do we start to celebrate male and female difference? Do we start to celebrate motherhood? But is there not the danger that if you celebrate motherhood, you leave women back in the home without economic opportunity? So it's a difficult agenda. We've been grappling with it in Britain. We don't know whether to educate for gender difference or educate for gender similarity. It's a debate for discussion group. The aspect when we went in, I won't read out all these quotes, these are quotes from the young women in Kibera and the The first quote actually says that the state power in Africa remains conspicuously male power, ingrained with predominantly male values, ideology, and vision of the world. It's not surprising if women in our research did not engage with the public sphere because it was seen as predominantly male. They are arguing we should have, in the second quote, 50-50% of men and women in politics. But at the same time, in the third quote, when they went down to the rally, the election rally in Kibera, there was violence in the election offices. They were facing violence when they went there. And in the end, when we looked at how they used the discourses of rights within the rights to the state, what they're really, the young women, are talking about, in contrast with the men, is that they're saying, I've got my children, I've got my siblings, I've got my mother, that's my world. And the young men are talking about voting, getting into stopping the violence of corruption and violence in the political parties, and trying to improve their community. There's a very big difference between the way in which the rights of the citizen are being interpreted by young people. This does lead to this argument I want to make, that we have to promote research in the country to actually look at. I don't see many examples of curriculum analysis of the textbooks that are being produced in the countries, and whether these legacies of public-private are still in there, how teachers are engaging with it, who has agency in the school. We found in, for example, Finnish schools that the boys had many opportunities to show agency, the girls didn't. And that these violence and sexuality issues are part of citizenship education. I won't do that one. The next agenda is around, the most controversial is around human rights. All of us will support the United Nations Convention of Human Rights. In fact, it's now, we said, it's a terribly unproblematic agenda. I mean, Bauman, as a sociologist, writing about it, said anyone who says they don't support human rights must be either unbelievably aggressive or crude or primitive and not a civilized person, because we all believe in human rights. However, it is being experienced as a highly controversial agenda in many countries, particularly in relation to Islamic situations. And many Commonwealth countries are a mix of Islamic and Christian traditions. And the reason why it's been seen as that, as the human rights agenda, and we are definitely educating young women to pick up that language, and young men to pick up that language, that they have human rights, not just rights of the state, but human rights, is that it challenges at a fundamental level the sexual and reproductive rights in the family. Once you say, I have a human right to choose who to have a relationship, how many children, when to get married, how to get married, you are fundamentally challenging the family structure in religious cultures. And that is where it's seen as a Western Trojan horse that is actually coming in, a new form of imperialism. If young women speak this language, where will we go next? So we have a problem here. Here's a girl. Look how many times she's talking about her rights. I have a right to go to school, to be married, the right to love, to right to choose what I want to do, to follow cultures, because I cannot be forced to choose to do what my parents want. As a girl, I must not go to be circumcised because my parents follow the culture. I'm not supposed to do that because we've got some communities which will follow their culture. But as for me, I can't follow them. I'll only follow them if they're good. She's positioning herself against traditional customs because of the language of human rights. This is where the gender debate is at. And I go to conference after conference now of this issue around how do you square those sexual reproductive rights, the rights of autonomy and control, when it challenges traditional cultures. Is it actually another form of colonialism, imperialism, etc.? 2 minutes. 2. I'm just getting going. There you go. There's a boy who's saying, he's got the language of rights. He's in Ghana. There's a lot of human rights education, as we know. Ghana was the first country to sign the UN Convention, African country, to sign the Convention of Human Rights. The young people living in acute poverty are using this language that we have brought in. And it's right to choose. I'm not talking against the rights language, by the way. I'm saying the consequences, that when young people start to use this language that is carried through the school system and through NGO work, it's actually raising very high expectations. Never mind the dreams. Mm. This is the high expectation of the state, and it's the high expectation that they have rights that need to be addressed. My third agenda for discussion in the discussion groups is this notion of the girl child, and I've just given a little poster from a school in Ghana. But the girl child debate is in many different countries. what is the problem with the girl child is you've got the girl child, as Elaine has pointed out, the girl child is a unitary category and has got no diversity in it. It's just one type of girl. And then you get the boy child. You get a lot of emphasis on the girl child. The discourse is there. I would not wish to use that language. I would sort of talk about young women as citizens. And once you do that, you can start to say there is huge diversity, ethnicity, class, regionality, and religion, and we should be doing research on how young women from different groups experience the school system. We cannot get substantive gender equality without transforming masculinity. Full stop. It is not actually possible. We know that from the Western movements. We know that we have to start engaging boys in discussing about gender equality. The UN was very aware of that and said, how do you transform the curriculum so that boys engage with helping young women achieve citizenship? And that empowering women is not going to be enough unless we actually start to engage with masculinity. And what comes through our research, when we interviewed young men and young women in, say, in Ghana and Kenya, also in Pakistan, we've just been analysing the data, this notion of respect. How can boys keep feeling they're respected, but at the same time not oppress women? And I'm going to leave that one for discussion. Respect is at the core of masculinity. The young women talk about, how do I respect my husband, but at the same time control my own life? Also, some forms of aggressive masculinity are actually forms of resistance to very, very extreme poverty and structural violence against them. And it's very difficult, therefore, if you remove the celebration of masculinity in a context where they're suffering acute poverty. And we have that in Britain, the same issue. Finally, there is change going on. These big debates are still embedded now in what's happening in education in the countries we've worked in. But we do see micro change. And the topics we've been raising have been very much the macro policy, the big policy statements, the government agendas, the big interventions. But actually, the change is happening through schooling, and we see it in our data. There are changing communication skills between boys and girls. They're not all seeing each other as sexual targets. They're seeing each other, he's like my brother, because the schools are co-educational and are starting to change gender relations. And I put in the mothers-in-law theory because, as my colleagues know, in India, when we went and interviewed wives, young wives, the moment of change comes when you turn to your mother-in-law and say, I want to do something different. It's the mother-in-law that they stood up against. So schooling works at a very micro level of change. Small acts of citizenship, we're not just looking at big representational statistics and massive national patterns. So I'm going to finish there, and I'm just going to put that up as the sort of things I would want on the agenda. Thank you.
Thank you.